questions. Rosella, you had a question.
Yes, I am currently, my husband and I are at a small urban congregation in North Philadelphia. And I had a question because yesterday we were talking a little bit about tapping into the resources of the people of the congregation and, you know, the retired folks or particular sectors of our congregation who may have gifts for ministry in terms of business or different things like that. What happens if you're in a position where the overwhelming majority of your congregation has not served in professional functions and don't have particular skills in regards to organizational management or things like that? How does one balance that reality?
There's an old book entitled The Suburban Captivity of the Church, authored by Gibson Winter. I would think that the book is at least 35 years old. The only reason why I mention it is because he was the first one that proposed that that we change the way in which churches function and suburban churches link up with urban churches. What I was suggesting was a Gibson Winter thing. You have this group of people over here who are really very, very well off in terms of resources, financial resources, personnel, et cetera. The inner city church, on the other hand, as is the case of the church you're talking about, is poor in terms of financial resources, in terms of professional people in the congregation. The idea is that there has to be some kind of linkage between those churches. And there has to be a commitment on the part of the suburban church to release people who can fit the needs that you're talking about. In the city of Philadelphia, there is a particular advantage that you can cite. Let's say you were doing economic development. There is actually an organization, a voluntary organization, of retired corporate executives who make themselves available to be consultants for small nonprofit organizations and for churches who want to do economic development work. You might tap into that. The ideal thing is to get a suburban church, however. And the suburban church has to be not casual about this. They have to, in fact, choose people who might be really, really important to the life of their church and say, look, as important as you are to us, we have a sister church in the inner city that desperately needs your presence. Are you willing to make a commitment to become, quote unquote, urban missionaries? That means you're going to commute into the city, you're going to go to that church, you're going to be a part of that church because you're going to help those people do these things. Interestingly enough, a member of our board of directors of EAPE, Lou Fisher is one who picked up this challenge as an individual. He's Roman Catholic. He lives out here in a very posh suburb, but he has identified with a Roman Catholic parish in West Philadelphia that is in very, very bad shape, very, very desperate straits. Now, he has a lot of money. And what he does is he takes 10% of his income and puts it in this inner city church, which I think is about half of their annual income. He makes a real big contribution there. But more than that, he goes in there. And he's gotten a group of his friends. He belongs to this kind of Ignatian, after St. Ignatius, this Ignatian fellowship where people volunteer to do work where there is need. And so it becomes borrowing people from other churches to come in and do it, because that's the only real answer that you have, unless, of course, they have somebody like Rosella, who has been through this wonderful course in urban economic development and social change, and then you can, in fact, provide a lot of these services in that area. There's a lot of consulting services around. I know for a fact, Iola, you tell them a little bit about what you're doing in consulting in economic development.
I work in urban commercial corridors, downtrodden, or I should say up and coming urban areas, to provide or to help micro entrepreneurs fill vacancies and they have businesses that are relevant to the surrounding community. So when you see a urban area that has boarded up storefronts, I'm working to get micro entrepreneurs in those storefronts to provide services for the community.
So maybe somebody like Iola can help. Also, there's a enterprise organization. Center. What's the full name of it? Down at 46 and Market Street.
It's called the Enterprise Center.
The Enterprise Center. They can help a great deal. They're more than willing to help. On the board of directors of EAPE, and I talked about Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education, that's a mouthful, we have really indoctrinated our board members. So one of our board members, Alan Beverly, is an industrialist. He's started many, many companies and sold them off, and more companies and sold them off. And so we talked him into going into Philadelphia. He lives out here in Radnor Township. He goes into Philadelphia. He attends a church there, New Bethlehem Presbyterian Church. And he became very involved in the life of the church, so much so that they have made him an associate pastor. So here's this white dude, as they would say, who is the associate pastor in this church. But his specific assignment was simply to get the church, first of all, business organized. So, you know, get the books in order, make sure the finances were going right, put up some kind of rational fundraising system and some kind of budgeted system, all of that to the plus side of the order. Then he started small businesses. He started a cleaning business. This worked out very well for him because he owns a company that's located up in the Souderton-Lansdale area that produces cleaning machines for floors and for other cleaning machines for buildings. So he started a cleaning business, using the machines, of course, and that's operating out of the church. Incidentally, that's a very easy business to start. Cleaning windows, cleaning offices. He started a cleaning business, and the people in his church, many of them now, are working in this cleaning business, and the whole business is operating out of the context of the church. So this can be done with somebody coming in from the outside. However, the ideal situation is if somebody comes in from the outside and really wants to do this, it's okay if they commute. The ideal thing is to convince people to move into the neighborhood and to really become part of the neighborhood. We hear a great deal about racial conflict. You know, that when a group of white people come into the black community, quote unquote, to do good, that they are really going to be treated with very negative reactions. The reality is that's not true if one thing happens, if they come and live in the neighborhood. What people cannot handle is folks riding in from the suburbs all the time and doing all of this stuff and then retreating to the suburbs. Now, in a consulting role in a church, that's another story. But to live in the community, John Perkins, who is kind of the guru for poor people doing, being served in the inner city, says we have to not only talk about redistribution of wealth, we have to talk about relocation. And my son has no problem in an African-American community for a very simple reason. He lives there. He's part of the community. Racism tends to disappear when, in fact, people actually live in the community. We have some people here who are with Missioneer. Where were you working, Stephanie?
Nicetown, North Philadelphia.
Nicetown. And you moved into the community. Mm-hmm. And when you first came, I'm sure there was a certain amount of suspicion about you.
They thought we were narcs.
Yeah, well, we had a very interesting situation a few years ago where we moved a group of workers into West Philadelphia, into this very, very tough neighborhood. And there were four white women and two white guys, and they're living in this storefront place on Woodland Avenue. It's kind of a funny story. And everybody treated them with great respect, almost with awe. They couldn't handle what was going on here. They didn't have a telephone, but there was a payphone across the street, and these guys were always running out to make phone calls and then coming back. And what was even more interesting was all of these young people were flowing into the house and out of the house all day long, particularly young men, you know, because they were ministering, they were running tutoring programs, they were running all kinds of programs. The image in the neighborhood for the first 3 months was that this was a house of prostitution, and number one. Number two is that they were, and the reason was the guys were using the payphone, you see, rather than, you know, because payphones don't get tapped, so, you know. So not only was it a house of prostitution, But they figured the only people who would set up a house of prostitution in this neighborhood was the mafia. And so nobody messes with the mafia. So these people were treated with great deference. You don't mess with these people. So you get all these kinds of things. But they thought you were narcs, right?
Only for like the first week. And then there was a teenage boy who came in and kind of checked out the place and reported back to everybody. And everybody loved us.
And then after that, it was okay.
Yeah.
Once they realize you're here to stay, that you're not here for the two-week tour of the city, what we call poverty touring, which is big with church youth groups, they can get quite good towards you. They feel very positive towards you. So if you can get people to do that, we have to get people to start thinking of themselves as missionaries. And I can fully understand why a young couple with children would not want to do this, because you don't want to get into that school system, which is often quite disastrous, as I was saying before. But here's a retired couple. I mean, my goodness, why don't you do something exciting with your life? Why don't you move to where you really can make a difference? Why don't you leave that boring suburban community? And suburban communities are really boring. Why not leave that and move into the city where every night is wild, right? Gunshots, parties on the streets. It's whatever you can say about the city, it's not boring. And so why don't you move in? I think we have to start convincing suburban churches to stop being so selfish with their enormous resources and begin to make commitments like this. Okay, into solid sociology today. I mentioned that in the early part of the century, Center for All Sociological Studies was the University of Chicago. And then, so much so that they talked about the Chicago School. And it was the epitome of research and thinking and study of urban life. There were other places where sociology was being taught. Harvard had a course under Becker and Sorokin. And that's another story because it's a very unique experiment. I love the course. The first course offered in sociology in the United States was offered by Lester Ward at Brown University. Now, you'll love this title of the course, because it's really what sociology is when you really get down to it. Because sociology, as Auguste Comte, the founder of our field in the modern time, at least the ascribed founder, I don't know whether that's true or not, but the ascribed founder said that sociology was the queen of the sciences. You have to know psychology, you have to know economics, you have to know politics, you have to know everything to do sociology, to understand a community. You have to know art, you have to know music, you have to know everything. The name of the course, the first course taught in sociology in this country, was entitled A Survey of All Knowledge. Now, there's an arrogant title for a course, A Survey of All Knowledge. You know, what are you studying in school? Everything. I'm a sociology student. I'm studying everything. But the real center of sociology was out there in Chicago. And the studies at Chicago were headed up by the chair of the department, a man named Robert Park. That's a very important name to get down, Robert Park. Robert Park, interestingly enough, never wrote a book. He never wrote a book. And yet, he influenced urban sociology more than anybody else. Robert Park came up with the concept of natural zones. Have you got that concept? Natural zones, or better called, natural areas. He says, when you look at a city, do not see the city simply as an entity that needs to be studied as a whole. The reality is, a city is a multiplicity of small cities. Later sociologists, would call these urban villages. Let me just say Philadelphia is a good example of urban villages. For instance, when Italian immigrants started coming to the United States, they didn't simply settle indiscriminately across the city. Everybody in Philadelphia knows they moved to South Philadelphia. Why? Well, the pattern of immigration in those days was a very simple one. The first people to leave the village in Italy would be the men. They would come over and try to establish themselves and get a house, get a job, get everything set, and when they felt they had enough money and were stable enough, they would then bring over their families. This still goes on. Puerto Ricans, Nicaraguans, Dominicans still tend to do this. The men come over first. They establish themselves. They get a place for the family to live. They rent a place. They get some furniture. They get a job. They set themselves up, and then they send for the wife and the kids to come over. And so they would settle in. But then somebody else from the village, from that same village, would want to come. So what would the first person do? Say, look, I'll meet you at the boat, and you can come and stay with me at my apartment until you can get yourself settled. And so the second family would come and connect in the same neighborhood. You can see that would happen. And then another, and another, and another. It reached a point where they would often bring over not only all the people of a village. One by one, the families would relocate. Not only would the village from Italy be set down in South Philadelphia, but in addition to that, they would bring over the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Eventually, even the priest would come over. They would have a reestablishing of the village in Italy in South Philadelphia. I mean, this was very pronounced when I was a boy. It's breaking down now. It's very pronounced. As a matter of fact, you probably heard the word paisan. You know, he's a paisan. What that means in Italian is you're from the same village I'm from. Hey, paisan, I mean, can you imagine somebody coming to America from a little village in Sicily, coming across, landing in Ellis Island, going through the craziness of the immigration process, then being met on the island of Manhattan by somebody from South Philadelphia who takes him into Philadelphia. I mean, can you imagine coming down on the train, these huge buildings, people from America who go to New York and have never been there are awed. Can you imagine somebody from a little village in Italy coming over? I mean, awed, staggered by all of this. And you're so frightened and everything's so unfamiliar, everything's so different. And you turn the corner of a street and here are like 20 people who you knew as you were growing up in this little village in Italy. No wonder you're going to say, paisan, you know, hey, I'm back home. I'm with my own people. So much was this the case that in the study of urban villagers by William White Jr., the tendency was to completely reestablish the lifestyle of the village. William White Jr. says the whole village life was reestablished, even to the point of shopping. Now, the last vestiges of this are left in Philadelphia. And in most cities, the last vestiges of urban village life are there. If you go down to 9th and Washington Avenue on Friday night and Saturday morning, no point going the rest of the week. Nothing's going on there. Oh, there'll be a little bit going on, but not much. Friday night, Saturday morning, that's when everybody would go to the market in the village. That's when all the farmers would come in with their goods and set up their, and you'd have this village market. 9th Street between Washington and, let's say, about Catherine became a village market. Even till this day, if you go down on Friday night, Saturday morning, nobody sells anything in stores. Because in the old village back in Italy, you didn't sell stuff in stores. There were no stores. If you've been to Europe, you know that on market day, they come and in the central area, they set up their tables and you put your goods out there, your food out there, and you huckster. You yell at people to buy stuff. And it's not as much fun as it used to be. When I was a boy, it was fun to go shopping on 9th Street on Friday night. Because you walk down the street, first of all, they not only move stuff out on the sidewalk, they don't move it out on the sidewalk. They move it out onto the street itself. You say, well, how does the traffic get by? Point, the traffic doesn't get by. There was a trolley car line that ran right down 9th Street. Guess what? Friday night, Saturday morning, the trolley cars did not go. You couldn't get through because the whole street was taken over by these vendors who would move all their things. You got stores, but stores were exactly that. They're places where you stored your goods, waiting for Friday and Saturday, and you moved all the stuff you had stored out onto the street. And the whole replication of the Village Market was there. You can still go down and see the remnants of it. The problem is that Asians have taken over all the selling. Upperly mobile Italians have moved into other kinds of work. The new immigrants have tended to take over these particular stands. There are still a lot of Italians down there. As a matter of fact, whenever there's a presidential campaign, everybody is going to, I guarantee you, is going to have his or her picture taken at 9th and Washington Avenue. There's a big Italian store there, and you want to go there because if you don't go there, you have not paid your homage to the Italians of Philadelphia. You must show up. And if you go in that place, they have pictures of every president, starting with FDR, every person who is a president or ran for president, because they all come. This is the center of Italian life. At least it has been up to this point. It's changing quickly now. It's changing quickly. But you had this situation where the Village was replicated, and you had what we call the Italian section. As a matter of fact, Philadelphia is known for its ethnic neighborhoods. You got Irish neighborhoods, you got German neighborhoods, you've got all kinds of neighborhoods. These neighborhoods are called natural areas or natural zones. I used to have my students here at Eastern get in vans, and we would drive down Haverford Avenue into Philadelphia. It's not as clean cut as it once was. I want to tell you, the natural areas are breaking down. But if you traveled into the city on Haverford Avenue, you would find the following to be true. As you come down Haverford Avenue from the suburbs, it's lily white Protestant. Lily white Protestant. Protestant churches, Presbyterians all over the place. You come down the street and you cross over City Line Avenue. When you cross City Line Avenue, you go move into a Jewish neighborhood. It wasn't 10% Jewish. It's not 20% Jewish. It was like 150% Jewish. I mean, it was totally Jewish. You cross the City Line Avenue. One side is totally white Protestant. You cross City Line Avenue, and it's totally Jewish. It's the remnants of that are still there, and they're very evident. Bagel shops, Jewish delicatessens, synagogues. Actually, there's a church in the middle of this area. Guess what? It's a Messianic Jewish church. You know, namely, it's for Jewish Christians. I mean, there were no other kinds of Christians except Jewish Christians in this neighborhood. It's a totally Jewish neighborhood. And it was Jewish park, Jewish psychologists, Jewish doctors, Jewish dentists. If you drive in there even today, you'll see that it is still overwhelmingly this. And it's a Jewish neighborhood par excellence all the way until you get to Lancaster. You cross Lancaster. Note, one side of the street is one ethnic group. The other side of the street is another ethnic group. It is totally, totally Italian. Italian Catholic churches, you know, got an Italian American club. You got pizza shops. You got Italian funeral homes. Now, I'll tell you about the importance of that in a moment. Italian funeral homes, very prominent. You'll see two or three of them on the street. It's totally Italian. And five blocks later, you cross 63rd Street. You obviously know.
I live in Overbrook Park.
Yeah, well, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The minute you cross 63rd Street, it becomes African American. Not 10% African American. Not 20% African American. It's like 100% African American. Now, these are what we call natural areas. Natural areas. White Protestant up to City Line Avenue. City Line Avenue over to Lancaster. It's totally Jewish. From there over to 63rd Street, totally Italian. Cross 63rd Street, it's totally African American. These are very, very carefully demarked areas. And if you take a trip down Haverford Avenue, to a large degree, you will still see this pattern existing. It's beginning to break down, so you'll see the evidence of what the textbook calls about the invasion of other groups. These groups are being invaded. When I was a kid, there was no crossing over at all. And if you lived in the Italian section, if you lived between Lancaster and 63rd Street, you lived there. You stayed there. The last thing you would want to do is cross 63rd Street, because this is not your community. This is not your country. These are not your people. And black people, on the other hand, would not cross over 63rd Street into the Italian community. And when housing pressures began to push African-American people across the line because there was no else to them to go, there was incredible tension. The people would move in to this neighborhood. Now, get the picture. You'll begin to understand some things now. They'll move into the section, and people will throw rocks through the windows. They will picket the house. They will do everything to drive the family out. And in most instances, they succeed. Because if you're an African-American family, you want a nice place for your kids to live. You move into this neighborhood. It was a clean, lovely neighborhood. And all of a sudden, people are throwing rocks. They're making phone calls. There's threats. There's rocks coming through with notes. If you don't get out of here, we're going to kill you. It doesn't take you long to say, I think we better get out of here. And they were very, and you say, it's racism. It was racism. But it was racism as you don't understand it. Namely, this is an Italian community. Namely, not only don't we want blacks, we don't want Asians, we don't want anybody but Italians. It's ethnic pride, it's ethnic identity. You don't belong here. And the fact that you're black makes you very visible, but the truth is, we want to maintain this ethnic Italian neighborhood. The tension between these neighborhoods is very, 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 very great. Very great. Each of these areas is called what? Remember the phrase, natural area. And the reason why is this. The city planners did not ever sit down and say, let's structure the city. I will let the Italians live here, the Jews live here, the Protestants live here, the blacks live here. They never ever structured this. Nobody ever sat down and planned this to happen. It emerged in a natural process of competition, Darwinian theory. Namely, that these groups competed with one another for this territory. They competed with one another for these territories. And out of a natural process of competition, certain areas end up belonging to one group, other areas belonging to another group. Another group would own still another area. And so in a city like Philadelphia, they talk about the Italian section or the German section. You've heard these terms used. These come out of the Robert Park analysis, namely natural areas. Nobody planned them. They immerse. Here's a good sociological term, sui generis. They emerged in and of themselves, and there they are. They are entities in and of themselves. May I point out that each natural area has its own subculture. This is a very important concept, its own subculture. Now, when you think about culture as a sociology student, you think about the following: language, religion, social institutions. I mean, when you talk about culture, you're talking about the art, the music. You're talking about a total way of life, aren't you? Culture. Each one of these areas, natural areas, were areas each of which had its own distinct cultural system. So it wasn't just a racial divide. It was a cultural divide. Namely, if you lived in the Italian section that I just described, and you crossed City Line Avenue, it wasn't just that you were a white Italian in a black neighborhood. You wouldn't even know what was going on there. I mean, they talk a different language on the other side of 63rd Street. I mean, you would actually need a translator to help you understand what is being said because the vocabulary is different. For instance, if you come from the Italian section and you cross City Line Avenue and somebody said, are you dissing me? You say, diss? What do you mean, diss? Do you know what that word means? You do. A good urban student. Yeah. Did you diss me? You know what the term means, right? It means you disrespected me. You, the way you looked at me. Hey, you know, you're walking down the street. One of the things you don't do is you don't meet people eyeball to eyeball. If you're Italian, walk. This is called streetwise. There's a whole book written on being streetwise by Dr. Anderson of the University of Pennsylvania. That's the name of the book, of how different areas have different street behavioral patterns. And you've got to learn the behavioral patterns that belong to a community before you can walk down the street safely, which obviously you learned in Nicetown. It takes you a few months to figure out how do you walk down the street in such a way that you do not look like a stranger anymore, do you see? I mean, that's the way it is. I grew up in West Philadelphia, and I learned how to walk, man. I never got in a fight the whole time I was in high school. in a very violent neighborhood. Never got in a fight. I didn't have to. I know how to walk so that people were afraid. You know, you don't just walk in West Philadelphia. You kind of move, man. You know, you got to have that little swagger to you. Walk down the street, hey, man. There's a bounce to your step. Did you ever notice the bounce? I mean, you learn this. You don't just walk like this. You kind of bounce, man. You know, you walk, and you look people down and say, what are you looking at? You know, you back people off. That's why you folks get mugged when you come to Philadelphia. You don't know how to walk. You come down the street with that big Iowa smile of yours. We kill people like you, David. We kill people like you. You gotta know how to walk. There's a whole culture. The way you walk is a cultural thing, isn't it? And people in one culture walk one way, and people in another culture walk another way. Everything from eating habits to the way you walk, the way you dress, everything about you is culturally defined. And there's one culture on one side, in one neighborhood. There's another culture in another neighborhood. These are different values, different religions, very different religions, different language, different values. These are very important things to note. Yes.
But just because it's difficult to cross that line, that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it.
Well, if you're going to do it, do it. Don't visit. Go and live there. I said earlier that once you move into an area, you are very quickly accepted, even if you're from another culture, if, in fact, they don't decide to declare war on you. Obviously, when you were moving into the Nice Town section of Philadelphia, which is not a nice town. What a good name, Nice Town. If it's anything, it's not nice. But when you moved in, there was a suspicion about you at first. But little by little, they accepted you. But of course, the other side of the story is that they really viewed you as somewhat superior class of people in Nice Town. It's not, I hate to be nasty, but it's not hard to come across as being from a superior class when you move into Nice Town. So it doesn't have the same effect as if you came in and carried all the traits of a lesser social class. Now you say, are you suggesting that certain groups of people are a lower social class? I am simply saying this. W.I. Thomas from yesterday. If things are real in the imagination, they are real in their consequences. No, I don't believe that certain people are inferior and certain people are superior. Doesn't make any difference. If in a given neighborhood, the people believe that a certain group is inferior, then the consequences are obvious. When somebody from this group that is defined by the neighborhood as inferior moves into the neighborhood, the neighborhood people are going to rise up and say, they're going to hurt our neighborhood. There goes the neighborhood. We got to get rid of these people because they're going to drag down the neighborhood. The value of property is going to decline because these people, when you moved into Nice Town, nobody was saying the value of the house is going to go down. Nobody was saying this is going to drag down the neighborhood because you came with all the symbols and signs of a very upper middle class group. So it didn't have the same reaction as people who come in who are a threat. When people move in and they're going to lift you up, in most instances, not every, I mentioned Manayunk yesterday. At first, when people began moving in, everybody was thrilled. But when the price of real estate started going up and up and up and up, they got very nervous and began to get upset with these yuppies that were coming in and taking over their neighborhood. But in the initial stages, it basically, this is going to be good for the neighborhood, you see. When my son moved into the Walnut Hills section of Cincinnati, no problem. Here was this young Ivy League guy out of Brown University with his lovely family. And yeah, it was a tough neighborhood. But hey, he's no threat to the economic well-being of this community. Interestingly enough, economics plays heavily into all of this. If you feel that these people are going to increase the economic standing of the community, it has one effect. If you feel it's going to hurt the economic level of the neighborhood, it has another effect. And I'm going to pick up on that a little later because it's part of today's course of study, what happens when people start invading other neighborhoods. But at first, we start looking at these natural areas, each of which is a natural zone. You're absolutely right, Stephanie. We're called to go into all the world and preach the gospel. It goes back to what Chris was asking the other day, you know, do I become part of the neighborhood? And one of the things that will really upset people is if you're a group of white people and you move into an African neighborhood, African-American neighborhood, and you try to act like you're African. You know, who you kidding, man? Who you kidding, do you see? Be who you are, but make your place among them. And as long as you're not a threat, and you are a threat if the image is that there are negative economic consequences to you moving into the neighborhood, they will, in fact, make room for you. It's when you threaten the well-being of the neighborhood. For instance, if we took a group of African-American mission year kids, that's in your program, you know, if we took a group of African-American kids and moved them into a house in Radnor Township, this would not go well. As a matter of fact, we made sure that it wouldn't happen here. We passed a little law in Radnor Township that you cannot have more than one person who is not a member of your immediate family living in the house with you. We made sure that a group of African-American mission year kids would not move into this neighborhood.
Well, not just that, but any students that want to live
you got it.
Shared housing.
Well, you got a mess in this community. You got Villanova down the street. You got Cabrini across the street. These kids don't like living in the dormitories. You can see what's going to happen. So we put the screws on all of you. We don't want you living next door to us. You threaten us. And I don't care whether they're African-American or whether they're white. If you get five students from Villanova moving into a house, renting it for the year, because it's cheaper to do that than to live in the dormitory, the community is going to be in an uproar. Once again, it threatens the economic well-being of the community. You can see that, can't you? You can see it. You can see that five Villanova students, especially Villanova students, Eastern students, of course, are immaculately clean and wholesome, never do anything wrong. But you know, you're going to have parties in that house?
Yeah. Not necessarily.
You don't know Villanova students, evidently. why do you think they want to move into this house? In most instances, because they have all kinds of freedoms that they otherwise would not have. There'll be four or five cars parked out in the street. That's likely to happen. Agreed? I mean, you got five guys in the house. Chances are four or five of them each have cars. You're going to have cars on the street. You're going to have people coming or going. They will be coming and going at 2 o'clock in the morning. Don't tell me students don't come and go at 2 o'clock in the morning. Please, Stephanie. And you're living in this lovely, peaceful neighborhood. And all of a sudden, cars are driving in at 2 o'clock in the morning. And there's five cars parked out in front of the house. And there's a party now and then. And people are coming and going. And whoa. I don't want this. It's going to diminish the property values. That's what's going to happen. And whether it does or doesn't, your point is not necessarily. Doesn't make any difference what will happen. Not necessarily is a good statement. That's a very good statement. The problem is if things are real in the imagination. That's why that statement yesterday was so important. If things are real in their imagination, they are real in their consequences. The minute the students move in, let's say they behave themselves perfectly. And don't do all these nasty things I'm telling you about. Nevertheless, the people in the neighborhood are what? Expecting them to do these things. It has the same effect. We don't want them in the neighborhood because we know what students will do. And these students say, but we're not like them. Ha, 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 goes the answer. We don't want to take the chance. Do you follow this? So let's talk about natural areas. Each natural area emerges sui generis, and nobody plans it. It comes into being. Each of these neighborhoods has its own culture. Now, for those of us who are going into Christian ministry, which in one way or another is almost everybody in this room, for those of us that are going into Christian ministry, this has serious consequences. You can see them immediately. If you're going to establish a Christian work, a community center, an outreach ministry, the point is that the outreach ministry will only be able to extend as far as the natural barriers of the natural zone, right? If you establish something in the Italian section, you're going to go as far as 63rd Street. Your ministry is not going to reach across 63rd. If you're on the other side of 63rd, you're not going to move into the Italian neighborhood. I mean, you may try, you may go and visit, you may knock on doors. They're not going to come. Do you see why? As a matter of fact, it's dangerous to cross into the other area. We had a great example of this in our summer program with with EAPE, Evangelical Association for the Promotion of Education. We had a great example of this. We decided to take a group of young people who lived in a housing development in Southwest Philadelphia, rather in Southeast Philadelphia, in Washington Homes, it's called. And the parents brought their kids to this thing. They were going to be taking the kids to the zoo. So the kids came at 12 o'clock noon, and they got piled on the buses. And the parents were told to pick up their kids at 5 o'clock. Well, it so happened that they pretty much exhausted the potentialities of the zoo by about 3:30. It was time to leave. The kids were going to be problems from this point on. So they pile them on the bus, and they're driving back to the housing development. But they're running about an hour early before the parents will come and pick up their kids. So they say, oh, there's a playground over there. It was in the middle of the Italian neighborhood. There's a playground over there. Let's get the kids out and get them on the playground, and we'll go on the sliding board and the swings, and we'll play games, and we'll have a wonderful time. So these 40 kids pile off the bus, these African-American kids from this government housing project, into this playground, into this square blocks playground in the Italian area. They are there about 10 minutes, and descending on the neighborhood are all these tough Italian kids, bigger, older kids, who start beating up these kids, yelling, get out of here. And the kids run, and they're scared, and they pile on the bus, and they're crying, and we get them back to the housing development, and everybody's upset, and the mothers come to pick up their kids. Are they mad at the Italians? No, they're not. They are mad at these young people who ran the excursion. Don't you know we don't belong in that neighborhood? They didn't take this course. Don't you know you can't go into that neighborhood if you're black? They don't come to where we live. We don't go where they live. That's how we get along. We don't cross the barrier. And that's the second thing about natural zones, according to Park. The barrier. Natural barriers. No, nobody said 63rd Street is a dividing line. But it is. It's a natural barrier. It emerged, here's the phrase, sui generis, means nobody planned it. Sui generis is S-U-I. Second word is G-E-N-E-R-I-S. It's a sociological term that we use all the time. Nobody planned it. It just happened. This natural barrier separating the two natural zones. Now, when talking about gangs, we got a very important issue here. Gangs, according to Thasher, T-H-A-S-H-E-R, Thasher, who wrote a book called A Study of 1001 Gangs in Chicago, Illinois. Thasher said, in studying gangs, where do they come from? How do they emerge? Generally, you have some group that starts as a play group. When you say play group, I don't mean they're playing hopscotch or something. They hang out on the corner. They're just buddies. They're just friends. They're just, you know, getting along fine. And they're having a good time. But there's one play group that is at the corner of Haverford Avenue and 63rd Street. It's just across the street from 63rd. Guess what? There's another play group on the other side. Gang hanging out on the corner. Now, these groups are not gangs at this particular point. They are just informal play groups. They hang out together. They have fun together. They go to the movies together. You know, it's the gang, man. Going down and hang out with the gang down at the street. It's not really a gang yet. What happens is that for one reason or another, there ends up being a fight between the gang in one natural zone with the gang from the other natural zone. There ends up being a fight. The first time the fight occurs, one group loses. It's going to happen. One group loses. When the group that loses, this is a generalization to be sure, reflects on what happened, you know, the next day. Hey, man, what happened yesterday? I don't understand what happened. We got beat. We let those guys beat us. We're not going to let that happen again. And they begin to organize now. They begin to organize. As a matter of fact, what they will do is look to the natural leader. Who's going to, you know, if they come again, Joshua says, they come again, I am going to, when I give the signal, nobody runs. You understand? Here's the word. Anybody runs, if they don't beat you up, no problem. We will beat you up. If you dare to leave when the conflict starts, you're in real trouble. More trouble than if you stayed and fought. Consequently, you're going to see what is eventually going to happen. It becomes almost impossible to leave a gang. It becomes almost impossible to ever quit a gang. They won't let you leave. You're part of the army now. This is not simply leaving a gang. This is a defection from an army. And you begin to get more and more organized. Next thing you know, they're going to start getting violent, more violent, maybe knives, maybe baseball bats, maybe even guns now. The problem is with guns, you got a problem because the cops know what's going on. Cops are very smart. They know that this group is no longer simply a bunch of innocent kids hanging out on the street corner. They are now a kind of together, and they've got a leader, and they've got a war plan, and they've got weapons. So what we're going to do is we're going to descend on them, and we're going to search them for weapons. Oh, we've got a solution to that. When they start searching for weapons, they're going to feel us up, see whether we've got weapons. How do we solve this problem? Stop to think. How do you solve this problem? Well, it's easy. You develop a sister gang, a group of young women, and they carry the weapons because when the cops come, don't you touch me. I'll report you. You got the point here, that it becomes very, very difficult for male cops to frisk women. And so women become very necessary in this system. And so most gangs have a sister gang that become weapons carriers. Or they will get a little boy to do the weapons carrier. They will also develop, this begins to emerge into a very sophisticated organization over the time. And number one is you get negotiators. You get somebody who, we're going to have a gang fight. Yeah, we're not going to put up with this, man. We're going to get you people. Say, look, the cops are right around here. If we start a rumble, they're going to arrest us all. We meet over in Cobbs Creek Park at 3 o'clock tomorrow. But who does all the negotiating? It's just like a regular army. You got a leader of the gang. You got a negotiator. You begin to see how this thing emerged. You got arms bearers. I mean, a whole system is beginning to emerge. It gets more and more and more organized. Of course, now you got a problem you don't have any money. The gang begins to take on criminal dimensions. I mean, it's a horrible thing, but these are the way gangs emerge. But they emerge with playgroups encountering other playgroups at natural barriers through conflict. Any question on this? This is Thasher's theory. Let me just say, in sociology, there is no explanation of social behavior that applies in every situation. All we do is come out with generalizations. The reality is, what we basically say is, in an ideal scenario, this is what happens. There's all kinds of deviations from the ideal scenario. It's called an ideal type. That's a term used by Max Weber, an ideal type. You always define the situation in terms of ideal types. That's the place you start sociological analysis. Now, when you analyze a situation and it doesn't fit the ideal type, and you're going to find this, in what ways did you meet up with this gang and it didn't really fit the scenario of the ideal type that Thrasher was defining? Now you begin to say, there are ways it deviates from the ideal type. Why does it deviate? Now you begin to see how sociological studies are formed. You don't start from scratch. You start from the theoretical groundwork that has been laid for you. And you say, okay, here's theoretically what I expect to happen. I went in there, and here was this gang, and it didn't come into existence that way. Why didn't it come into existence that way? And I begin to explore those particular factors. Robert Merton, you need to know this name. Robert Merton, for many years, the dean of American sociology, calls this the serendipity pattern of investigation. Got this? The serendipity pattern of investigation. It's a sociological term. Almost every sociology student knows it. The serendipity pattern of investigation. What do? You start by understanding the situation given the theories that were handed to you. But when you try out the theories, you find that they don't exactly fit. They don't exactly work. That there are all kinds of deviant patterns that emerge in the group that you're studying that make it different than what you expected. The theoretical framework that you came with out of the textbook led you to have certain set of expectations. But when you get there, some of those expectations are actualized, but others are not. And there are things that your theoretical expectations never anticipated. There are unanticipated events that break the pattern, which means you have to do what? You have to go back and recast your theory in such a way that it takes into account what you have discovered through your actual existential encounters. And so you've got a new theory now, which takes into account the exceptional circumstances you ran into and explains them. So the next student comes along and takes your theory, your modified theory that came out of your serendipity pattern of investigation. You tried it and you found certain things. Lo and behold, you go and try it again. And again, even this new theory doesn't work because there are other circumstances. And so you modify it again and you go back. But you see what's going to happen. Every time you test out the theory, there's going to be deviations. And every time you have a deviation, you're going to have to recast your theory. Over a period of time, the theory becomes more and more complex, more and more developed, able to take into account more and more exceptions. This is the way sociology is done. Does the process ever end? No, it never does. This is the way sociology carries out studies, especially in the city. So you can't come with a theory and say, this is how it is. This is what I expect to find. It's a place to start. But from there, I have to take into consideration that nothing fits 100%. Weber called the theoretical framework you start with what? An ideal type. An ideal type. Let me give you a definition of an ideal type. An ideal type, says Max Weber, is a pure type. I love that phrase, pure type. If everything is just like it's supposed to be, it's a pure type. It's a pure type. Then he adds, that doesn't really exist. Namely, you can never find a pure type, but you construct it. It's a hypothetical. There's a big phrase. It's a hypothetical construction. It's a hypothetical construction that is a pure type. It's a pure expression of what you're looking for. A hypothetical pure type that doesn't exist in the empirical world. Next phrase. But could. Nobody's saying it couldn't be this way. You just can't find one that's perfect.